Send me an angel right now. Empty dreams can only disappoint. That's real life. Or if you enjoyed the Pop Goes Punk, Punk Goes Pop compilations from like the early 2000s, then it's thrice. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jay's Talk Plus. Jay's sweep the Angels and now have an empty day. But they'll get the Angels again soon. They get them for four more starting Thursday back here. They are off today, and then they start a stretch of 18 games in 17 days because they have that makeup game against the Boston Red Sox, not this coming Monday, but the Monday following. They've got the Cubs on the road, all 2:20 p.m. starts Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Then they'll be back home for seven. Reds, that Angels team again that they just saw for three, swept three. Not a very good-looking Angels team, even though they'd played a little bit of better baseball over the last couple of weeks coming into this one. And then, yeah, five against the Red Sox. Have fun with that one. Jay Sweep, it's a 9-2 win yesterday. The headline item heading into the game is that Will Wagner didn't play. And you understand it. I mean, he's off to this really nice start over the first two games. All his hits have come against righties. He's 0-for-3 against lefties. It's a tough lefty on the mound. Although it should be noted the Jays don't really have any choice but to play at least a couple lefties right now because Wagner, Loperfido, Barger, Horwitz, Varsho. There's too many lefties now, so you're going to have a couple in there with the platoon disadvantage. But they decide to give Wagner the day off against Tyler Anderson. Works out. The offense really gets to Tyler Anderson. We talked yesterday about how he was having another good season, but some of the underlying numbers weren't quite buying it. The changeup, a very, very good pitch. The Jays were all over him. Ernie Clement, homers in the second inning. Vlad has an RBI single in the third. Varsho hits a three-run homer in the fifth after making what I'd imagine is the only mistake he's made in the outfield all year. Cost Jose Berríos a double in the second inning, but no run came around to score. But Varsho makes up for it. First of all, earlier in the game, Varsho also had a double. It hit the first baseman's glove and rolled into shallow right field, and he just managed to beat it out for a double. Then hits a three-run home run. Good stuff for him. Vlad had doubled in that inning as well and then kind of ran into a bad out on the bases. So, then he comes around and, makes up for it as well with his 25th of the season a little later on. Vlad just, I mean, every day there's a new stat from our pal Sarah Langs at MLB.com of things nobody has done since X that Vlad is doing right now. Our friend Jonah Bierenbaum providing the stat earlier today that obviously we're still very, very early on. There's a lot of baseball to play in the second half. But if the season ended right now, Vlad would have the best second half of the season OPS in league history. It's almost 1.5 since we turned to the second half. Sarah Langs providing that Vlad is the first player with a 26-game span where he has 25 extra base hits and is hitting 450. He's actually hitting 457. He's the first person to do that since Richard Hidalgo in 2000. And then before that, you got to go back to Willie Mays, Joe DiMaggio, Lou Gehrig. So Vlad on an unprecedented heater right now, not only in terms of Vlad, but in terms of all of baseball. By the way, if you are a Raptors fan, it's a good day to keep an eye on Twitter for what appears to be an announcement that's coming out about a jersey a little later today, as well as the schedule dropping there. You heard J.D. Bunkus earlier. There was obviously the Austin Matthews captaincy news. So ends up being a fairly busy week here for the Blue Jays. They get an off day today. Let's reset. Let's zoom a little outside of the Blue Jays too. We haven't talked to our next guest on the show in a little bit, but I want to take it back a couple weeks and talk to Julia Kreutz of MLB.com of sometimes Jays Talk Plus fill in about a bunch of stuff. Julia joins us now. How are you?
I'm doing all right, Blake. I gotta say, I don't think I had ever heard anyone say today is a good day to keep an eye on Twitter. But sure, that's the energy we're coming into Thursday with.
Yeah, I mean, you could do Instagram or Facebook or whatever if you prefer. It's just the Raptors have been heavily teasing something, and I thought I should mention. Yeah. Nobody should be on Twitter for their, general well-being. But some of us, that's a core part of the job, Julia. I know you do it much better of, like, you have Twitter to post your articles and to make fun of Keegan. You do it right.
Oh, my God. Thank you for noticing.
Okay. So one thing, I do want to talk baseball with you, but I want to be a little. So when we were at the ballpark together last weekend and there were all these Olympic gold medal things going on, Canada against Brazil in the volleyball final that a bunch of us were watching in the concourse and things like that. How were the Olympics for you? I know Brazil had a pretty good finish there, but you're watching a lot of these, and obviously you are here in Canada now, but you are Brazilian. How was that experience? How much fun did you have at the Olympics in general?
Yeah, I feel like, you know, maintaining all of my friendships at the ballpark after that volleyball, that beach volleyball game was a miracle, but it was fun. Didn't watch as much as I would have liked. I was in Thunder Bay covering the Women's Baseball World Cup for the first week of it. That was very intense. There was really no way to watch anything. And then week two, I was at the ballpark for 6 days. So you kind of watch here and there where you can. Heard a lot from family and friends. And one thing I have to say is that CBC does a tremendous job with coverage and play-by-play and all of that. And our pal Dan Shulman absolutely nailed it with basketball. It was so good. And I texted him to say that, you know, hearing him call that Canada-France game, albeit heartbreaking, it was kind of like coming home after a long day, you know, just hearing his voice on television. It was all great. I do miss Brazilian play-by-play because it is so campy and so blatantly in favor of Brazil. And I was like, it's like there's just a little bit of the experience missing for me, but all in all, so great, and get to see, you know, our guys, our people shining on that stage too.
Yeah, I watched a chunk of the French broadcast of the U.S. against France gold medal basketball game on the men's side, and yes, the specificity of each country's broadcast is fun. The devil named Curry is killing us. It was fun. There was also my favorite moment of that volleyball game was like you watching it on your phone and like, talking about, we came back, and someone around you thought that meant Canada came back, and you're like, no, Brazil. So you mentioned there, Julia, you were in Thunder Bay covering the Women's World Cup of Baseball. That was obviously a tournament that took place over a couple different legs there in Japan and in Thunder Bay. The finals were there. You did a lot of great work off of it for MLB.com. We haven't had a chance to talk to you about it on the show, so apologies for this being a week and a half old, but how was that experience? How'd you enjoy covering the Women's World Cup?
No problem. I'm actually glad you're bringing it up because I don't think that we should be talking about it only as it happens, right, Blake? I think that one of the main intentions here is to grow the women's game, and we do that by talking about it continuously rather than when there's an excuse to talk about it. So this is great. I think that we're doing a good thing here. That experience for me was probably different from, you know, a lot of the things that I've been doing recently. It kind of harkens back to a little bit early on in your career when access is great and people are really, you know, putting in the effort to be there, taking time away from work and moving pieces around so that they can play the game that they love. That was the vibe overall. And one, it's very inspiring to see how many women from all over the world are making those sacrifices, putting in the effort and being there playing good baseball. And at the same time, it really does open your eyes to how much growth still needs to happen on the women's side, right? That was very, very high level baseball. We have so many names, especially in North America, you know, for us, that are getting recognition now. People like Kelsey Whitmore, who was the first woman to play pro baseball in the men's league, or you have Olivia Pichardo, who became the first woman to play Division I baseball. You have so many of these names that are now popping up and are getting some recognition for their work, and we really do need to elevate those voices because what these women are doing is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it's very obviously I like our core job, and it's cool to talk to a player who's been in baseball. You know, we'll talk about Luis de los Santos, for example, in a couple minutes here. Right. Cool that guy grinded 10 years through baseball and things like that. But some of the stories you got to tell of like, hey, yeah, someone had to use their vacation time to be here and like for no pay, just do it for the love of the game and wanting to compete at that level. It's very cool. Another thing that really struck me from your work, and this is obviously one of the cool things about you as a person and as a writer, is you speak so many different languages. And that piece you did on the kind of language of baseball or vocabulary of baseball, talking to players from different teams and different countries and things like that. What did you take away from that aspect of it? This kind of like, hey, we all have a different vocabulary around the game, but we're all talking the same language.
Yeah, it's, in Canada, we obviously have some of those expressions, right?
Yeah.
Oh, this is coming out of left field, or this project is a total home run, or things like that. I think maybe we go a little more the hockey route, just from, where we are and what is popular around here. But you kind of notice that this is obviously not exclusive to us. In Brazil, we have 1 million metaphors about soccer that kind of seep into everyday life. And so started with the curiosity of, is this something that happens in other places as well? And then you talk to some Mexican people, and then you talk to some Venezuelan people, and then you're like, you guys speak the same language, you guys speak Spanish, and you have baseball metaphors that are different and are very reflective of your culture. Same goes for Japan. So you kind of start to notice that not only does baseball language seep into everyday life, it also goes back to the culture of each country and how people grew up and what they value. So, in Mexico, you're going to talk about coming sliding in or sweeping in as if you're stealing a base, to say that you just made it in time, right? You didn't have a second to spare for that meeting or to catch the bus or whatever. As a Brazilian, I could really identify because we're known for being late. Okay, this is something that I can understand. And then in Japan, you say something like having a conversation that is as easy as playing catch or as natural as playing catch. Well, this is a very fundamentally oriented culture. So it's natural that they would, bring in that type of element of baseball to everyday life. It was fascinating to me. That's the stuff that I live for, Blake. And it was also really, really nice. I was a little worried at first, like, am I just geeking out by myself here? But the interest was real, and people are messaging me and saying that they really appreciated it, and it was such a different angle. So it's one of those that kind of sneaks up on you. You're not really expecting anything of it, and it ended up being a pretty rewarding piece to write.
It was a lot of fun to read as well and talk to you about. So actually on the diamond, Canada did pretty well. They finished third. They beat Mexico in the third place playoff there. They have a pretty good run. You look at the wins and losses and the run differential and things like that. And then Japan wins, which they always do, but the United States was also pretty good. And Japan, they didn't have the run differential that we're used to seeing and things like that. How much more competitive is women's baseball getting at the international level at this, at this top tier, where it seems from afar that it's been like Japan and then a gap and then the US and then, okay, everyone else. Are we getting closer to like a little more parity, a little more like what we saw in the basketball in the Olympics, where the U.S. won, but they were pushed at every turn and things like that?
That's the exciting part, Blake. It's that the gap is narrowing. We can see that, especially in the States, the investments have picked up. This event had a 6-year hiatus because of COVID. And to quote manager Veronica Alvarez, who also works with the Oakland A's, they made good use of it. They really did. So there is more investment. U.S. baseball is more involved. MLB is more involved. So you have MLB develops events that are geared towards women, and you're starting to see the product of that on the field. The U.S. came in with the goal to win this tournament. And, if we were skeptical before it started, once play actually began, it became a very real possibility. And it's still a very real possibility that next year will end Japan's run. And, it's funny to hear Japan's manager, Risa Nakashima, after the gold medal game, in which there was never a dull moment in that game. So much happened. But I asked her, what do you think about this? The gap does seem to be narrowing. It seems like Canada and the States and, even to a certain degree, a team like Mexico are getting closer to you. How do you feel about that? And she says, I feel like that is a very good thing. I feel like we are heading into a golden age here and, really seeing the benefits of 20 years of work. So this tournament has been happening for 20 years. You have so many women who played in the first World Cup and who are still involved. Even on the Canada side, you have Ashley Stevenson, who works with High A Vancouver and was coaching Team Canada as well after having played every edition of the World Cup prior to that. And so it's not just that there is the intention of these women. You're also now seeing a little bit more incentive from behind the scenes and from other institutions that can really take the game to a new level.
Well, that'll be a lot of fun. And then another thing that I would imagine, I know we'll have another World Cup before then, but baseball being back in the 2028 mm-hmm. Summer Olympics in Los Angeles, I would imagine would be a nice little, not only a shot in the arm because, you know, people will be tuned in and it'll be a good platform for these women and things like that. But I would imagine, you know, teams are going to want to compete. There's going to be, not that there's ever going to be enough funding, but I'd imagine there'll be a little bit more muscle, you know, in that 2026 to 2028 range, trying to build this thing up for the Olympics.
Well, let's hope so, right, Blake? What I've heard so far, and I'm not necessarily sure here, so don't quote me on it, but it seems like it's baseball on the men's side and softball on the women's side, which is also, you know, a problem of its own because it's not the same sport, and we shouldn't gender it like that. So women can play baseball. Men can play softball. It's all good. So, you know, if anything, this will give us a platform to continue this discussion of women don't have to default to softball. They should have the option to stay with baseball because it is not the same game. And, you know, you have someone like Naomi Ryan on Team USA who says, yeah, I mean, I tried softball, but, you know, it's just not for me. I prefer baseball. So I just want to play baseball. And a lot of these women play both, right? So we're going to probably see some representatives of their nations in the Olympics, even if it is just softball. But a big part of the discussion is exactly that, Blake. It's that we're gendering a sport and then not giving people the right opportunities from the get-go, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And yeah, I mean, it being listed as baseball / softball, you know, like I know a number of the women will play on both. But like if we can, if for basketball, we can have 5-on-5 and 3-on-3 mm-hmm. in the Olympics, which are both, you know, it's not like the women play 3-on-3 and the men play 5-on-5. Both genders do both. I don't see why we couldn't have baseball and softball. I don't know if that's like 1,000% locked in yet, but hopefully they hear us on this. This is a quick aside, but do you want to see Major League Baseball players in the 2028 Olympics on the men's side?
Oh, I would love that. I think that would be so much fun, Blake. And you kind of like talk to, you know, the WBSC, which is the organizer for the World Baseball Classic and the Women's Baseball World Cup. You kind of talk to them, and they have so many stories of major league players who discovered a new love of the game by representing their country. The World Baseball Classic was a huge success when it came back, and there's a reason for that. Now, there's a lot of negotiation that's going to go into that. If I'm not mistaken, there's a new CBA ahead of the 2028 Olympics, so that would have to go into discussion there. But it would be so much fun. And I truly believe that, you know, with the amount of effort that the league is putting in right now to growing the game, what better platform to grow the game than the Olympic Games in LA?
Yeah. And it seems like a layup from a marketing standpoint. I know it's not as easy as like the NBA lets players go because it's during the off season and things like that. But the NHL has figured it out before with hockey. We could figure it out. I don't know. Is anyone going to be that mad if like for one season we have 144 game Major League Baseball schedule so that we could take 3 weeks off for the Olympics in the middle of the summer? I don't know. Revenue's a real thing, but I don't imagine it would be the end of the world. So hopefully we can work it out. Julia, let's pivot to the Blue Jays a little bit. I mentioned Luis De Los Santos a little earlier. You wrote a fun piece. Well, fun-ish, probably wasn't that fun for him. I know it was a piece that was taking a look at other prospects who could get called up as well. But Luis De Los Santos, you know, having that cool moment on the weekend, then finding out he's getting optioned. What was that conversation like for you? If I'm remembering right, you were the first person to know he was getting sent down because he brought it up.
Yeah, tough bounce for sure, right? You kind of understand where the Blue Jays are coming from, what they're trying to do with the rest of the season. It's to get a look at as many guys as they can. You have someone like Will Wagner waiting in the wings, and you have to send someone down because it's not September yet, and that creates a little bit of a tough situation. But, you know, when you look at De Los Santos' trajectory, the amount of work, 9 years, right? He's been in the organization since 2015, and for him to get there and get his moment, it was kind of cool, Blake, to see the level of, you know, just joy and gratitude that he was speaking with, even though he had just gotten the news that he was going to get sent down. And so it was very much a thing of like, you know, I asked him, when you look back at the day you signed and everything that you went through and now you're here, and all that you could say was, I'm extremely grateful and my family is very proud of me. And now I'm going to keep working and I expect to be back soon. So that is the mentality. That is the mentality that got him signed in the first place out of the Dominican. And they got it, they kept him grinding through 9 minor league seasons before getting to this point.
Yeah.
Still sucks.
Yeah, it definitely seems like it sucks. He's homered in his first 2 games with the Bisons since returning there. So he's obviously taking it in stride.
Soon.
Okay, so the other side of this is, of course, Will Wagner has gotten called up. I know you are not on the road, so you haven't got a chance to talk to Will Wagner yet, but your initial impressions here, pretty good first impression, pretty good debut from him.
Yeah, pretty much what we expected from Will Wagner, right? Good strike zone control, great contact, 26-year-old, so this is not necessarily, you know, a very young rookie kind of taking his first steps. So you can see that the IQ is a little bit more elevated as well. And he is showing as much on the field. I think the contact ability is the number one thing that we're going to zero in on with him. And the fact that he has, you know, the pedigree, the track record, the fact that his dad is Billy Wagner, the Astros all-time save leader to this day, and potentially Hall of Famer coming up next year or this year. So there's a lot to like about Will Wagner. And this is a guy that, again, he has put in the work. He has paid his dues. He's not getting by on his famous name or last name here. He has shown that he can have success. And, you know, we're obviously going to see the Blue Jays be a little bit careful with him at first. You kind of look at the lefty versus righty splits in his minor league career, and it makes sense that he may get a few days off here and there when matchups dictate. But so far, so good. I don't think you could have expected a better start to this career for a guy like Will Wagner. I'm very excited to see how sustainable this is. And once rosters expand and the Blue Jays can bring a little bit more of these young guys into the Major League clubhouse, how those dynamics play out as well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. You know, thankfully, the days of there being 40 guys in the clubhouse in September are gone. I think they could do a little bit more than 2 extra roster spots, but maybe split the difference there. But you had highlighted in that piece you wrote that, you know, the topper about Luis de los Santos. You had identified a couple prospects that, hey, this is someone we could see down the line, whether it's in the Luis de los Santos spot, even though we all kind of unofficially knew it was Will Wagner coming up, and maybe in September. So you highlighted Jonathan Clase, who's with AAA and was obviously a part of the Mariners trade package. Alan Roden, who's a drafted and developed within the system and got to AAA earlier this year. Jake Bloss, who made his first AAA start on Saturday with the Buffalo Bisons. Who are you most interested in? Or, I guess, which one of those guys would you be most curious to get a look at, let's say, September 1st here?
Yeah, I mean, I know that Class A has already had a little bit of a major league stint with Seattle, but the wheels on that guy, right? Like, it's you cannot even quantify how much value a guy like that adds on the base paths, which is something that the Blue Jays are not doing a ton of. We're not really seeing the Blue Jays run the bases with thunder in any way, shape, or form this year. I think George Springer leads the team with 13 stolen bases. It kind of tells you where we are. And obviously that's not the be all end all. It's not even the only thing that he brings to the table. There's also some pop in his bat, 20 homers last season between 2 minor league levels. You kind of see that this is a guy that fits very much the mold of power and speed type of thing. And then 79 stolen bases in the minors last year, which is a pretty eye-popping number. And again, not something that we have seen a ton of with the Blue Jays. I think that he is going to make his way into this major league roster at some point from now until the end of the regular season. And it's someone that we're gonna keep watching pretty closely here, not just because, you know, it was kind of like if I'm not mistaken, it was one of the first trades to kick off the deadline, and we were a little uncertain of what was coming, and then the Blue Jays pull off this deal. Ended up being a very successful trade deadline within the parameters of success that the Blue Jays set for themselves. And Class A is kind of in my mind at least, one of the headlining names for that process.
Yeah, and it's fun. The Jays haven't had that skill set in a long time. Like, over the last decade, the most a Blue Jay has stolen a base in a season is 26, and that was Whit Merrifield last year. Like, that's it, with stolen bases rising around baseball, that's not enough. Give me some juice, especially when you're not a home run hitting team.
Yep. That's so true. And, you know, Blue Jays should be a home run hitting team. We're seeing a little bit more of that now that things are going a little bit better. But you're right. I think that it's not just the excitement of what can a fan see on any given night. It is also how can these aspects of the game help us win more consistently if you're the Blue Jays and thinking about 2025. That is something that needs to be considered here. What is it that the team is lacking this year, and how can they make up for it in 2025?
Yeah, and Class A could be a part of that. And I'd imagine, Julia, like when you see a series like this where the Jays hit a bunch of home runs, obviously the Angels are not a particularly good team. Every one of their pitchers seemed to decide that the strategy was to groove curveballs 85 miles an hour middle to Vlad. I don't know what the scouting report was, but that's not it. Is that kind of like this is a little early for this conversation, but when the Jays do head into the offseason, when we do turn our attention to free agents and things like that, adding some thump to the middle of the order behind Vlad, is that kind of going to be front of mind for you?
I believe so, Blake. I believe so. It's very hard to predict what the market is going to look like and what the Blue Jays will, you know, actually have the ability to do. They should be in a pretty good place after shedding a lot of their high salaries at the deadline. But you have to, right? You can't look at how 2024 has gone and turn a blind eye again. This is something that needs to happen if the Blue Jays want to be competitive. And we all know, you know, where the fan base is in terms of its opinions about this team and the expectations having completely dwindled. So something will need to happen to instill some life in this club. I think that we're seeing that a little bit now in terms of there's just some freedom in playing without the stress, I guess, of making the postseason or making up for lost games. And, you know, their starters are bouncing back. The power is coming back. Great. How do we make sure that as a group this stays how it is? And how can they add to that? Because this is going to be an offseason in which everyone around the Blue Jays will be kind of under a microscope.
Yeah, it will be, and it should be, right? Like, even if you like the deadline and you like how fun things are here and, like, down the stretch with no tension and a couple of the prospects click, it's not where you're supposed to be. So everyone's going to be under the microscope there in the offseason. Julia, thank you so much for taking the time out this morning. Keep up all the wonderful work, and I assume see you at the ballpark next week.
My pleasure. I'll see you at the ballpark next week.
All right. Julia Kreutz of MLB.com. Yeah, Jays will be back home. They've got the Reds, and then they've got the Angels. But before that, they're in Chicago for a three set. Might have had a friend share a flight with one of our Sportsnet people on the way to Chicago today. Actually, my mom and stepdad are going down with my mom's in-laws and stuff to see the game in Chicago. They've never been to Wrigley. They're not like my family's not huge baseball or sports people, weirdly enough. But yeah, nice place to see a ball game. And I'll get the report about how many Jays jerseys there are from my mom down in Chicago, because that'll be the thing that she cares about most, I'm sure. A couple of small notes from the minor league system before we take a break and talk to one of the members of the minor league system. Arjun Amala remains red hot. He is one of the youngest players in all of A-ball. We talked a lot on the show about how he got this aggressive placement in A-ball to start the year, struggled a lot, got pulled out, went to the developmental list, went to the complex league for a couple games, now back in single A. This is not a stat just since he called back up. This is the stat for the whole season now, so it includes that rough start. He's now in the top 10 in OPS in A-ball as an 18-year-old, as one of the youngest players at the level. He's been pretty ridiculous. He had three hits, including a homer, again yesterday. So really nice to see one of the highest upside prospects in the Blue Jays system starting to figure it out, it seems. At 11 o'clock, we'll talk to Sam Dykstra of MLB Pipeline. They've got updated farm system rankings, a top 100 and an updated top 30 in the Blue Jays system. So we'll talk about Namal and a couple other guys with him. We'll talk to Nick Pollock of Pitcher List a little later, take the lay of the land of the Blue Jays pitching staff the rest of the way here. But after the break, we'll talk to one of those prospects who's been hitting pretty well. He's homered in consecutive games, had a nice little bat flip last night. He was the return piece for Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. Charles McAdoo, formerly of the Pirates system, now with the AA New Hampshire Fisher Cats, will join us after the break on Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL.
The J.D. Bunkus Podcast.
Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. A little story so far, though. The only band that I could think of from Walnut Creek, California, where our next guest is from. And I'm a little embarrassed because the guests on Zoom can see what's going on in the studio before I realize they can. And our colleague Ben Nicholson-Smith was asking me about a barber, and I was sending him a picture of my haircut. And I guess Charles McAdoo, newest Blue Jays prospect of the New Hampshire Fisher Cats, got a peek at it. Charles, what's up, man? Thanks for joining me.
How's it going, Greg? How's it going?
It's good, man. I got to ask you. So we only get one camera angle of the double A games, right? Like on MILB TV or whatever. Your homer last night, where did the bat land? Because it looked like you were getting ready to toss that thing after you hit it, but we didn't get the full camera angle of it.
Surprisingly enough, it didn't go very far, but I did almost take out the umpire's shins. So that was, I threw it, I was like, oh no. I almost took out his shin, had to go back to him like, hey man, sorry, I didn't mean to almost take you out there.
That's all right, man. You hit one like that, you can, you don't hit an umpire with a bat on purpose, but you can pimp it a little bit when you hit one out like that. So man, welcome to the Jays organization. Take me back to the trade a little bit. How did you find out? Kind of what was that day like when you find out you're going to be a Blue Jay on deadline day?
Well, I didn't think I was going to get traded because like, oh, this is the last day of the deadline. You know, I made it. I'm clear. But right before I was about to go out and stretch for my game in Altoona, they said, you got a second? I was like, yeah, sure. I thought it was for like an infield talk or something, like something that saw infield. But manager was in the room, infield coach was in the room. I see the manager on the phone. I'm like, okay, that's kind of strange for infield. Maybe the infield coordinator is the infield coordinator has to talk to me about something. And then he's like, are you sitting down? I'm like, no, why would I need to be sitting down? So I go ahead, sit down. He's like, you've been traded. And I like, my face just didn't know what to do. So just like, huh?
Oh man, that's, I mean, it's like, I guess it's a mix of like, it's a sadness, excitement. Like what is that emotion like? And like how much, once you find out it's the Blue Jays, you know, what do you start thinking then? Obviously the Pirates are the only thing you've known at the pro level, but it's not like you've been there too long or anything.
Yeah, it was mostly just shock. I was in pure shock for I think for like a few days, even getting into Binghamton where I met New Hampshire on the road. I was excited. I got to call my mom because she's gonna be confused while I'm not playing today. I don't want her to worry. Yeah, and then luckily enough, one of my roommates in Altoona let me take his car back to the apartment and I could start packing up all my stuff so I could get my life together.
So what has that side of it been, the transfer to New Hampshire? Obviously, you got to meet them on the road. You got to meet new teammates and things like that. And I'd imagine, you know, new conversations with people in the Blue Jays organization. How has that transition been kind of learning the new organization for you?
One of the big things that I was worried about is learning everybody's name and like getting people mixed up. But the transition has been rather easy. I'm starting to get the hang of everybody's names, which is good. And I'm not forgetting too much. They made it smooth. They're being super helpful with me and all the other guys that came up here with me. And it's just, they've just been helping us out a lot.
Obviously you're in New Hampshire now. Do you have a familiarity with Toronto at all? Like the city, have you been here? Do you know much about it?
I've never been to Canada, no.
Okay. Well, you got that to look forward to at some point. That'll be fun for you. What are the conversations like? Like, do the Jays talk to you much, or is it just kind of, hey, you get to New Hampshire and like the manager and the hitting coach are talking to you and you're getting it? Like big picture, have the Jays talked to you much about, hey, this is what we liked about you, this is where, you know, we want you to develop and things like that? Or is the focus kind of just, let's get this guy in the lineup every day and get his feet under him?
See, that was in the few days that Like everything was all jumbled up together. But I'm assuming it's like, get him in the lineup, get him some at bats. We know what he can do. We just need him to get comfortable around the organization.
So in terms of that, it certainly seems like the last couple of days you're pretty comfortable. Homered in two games in a row. I think you got, what, four hits over your last three games. How are you feeling in that regard? Like, I know the first couple games there you struggled a little bit, but it's just a couple games. Are you feeling pretty good now?
Yeah, I'm feeling pretty good. I think it was just more comfortability. It was always in the back of my head. I didn't feel like it was. I was trying not to think about it, but I feel like it was just more comfortability.
So in terms of your career to date in general, like you've been, you know, obviously the prospect, people know who you are. Jays fans, oh, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa for Charles McAdoo. Let's bring that guy's page up on MLB Pipeline or Baseball America or whatever. And the big highlight item with a lot of the stuff written about you is this guy has been really fast rising. You know, like, hey, great year. Goes from high A to double A. He's going to take a big jump in the rankings and things like that. Are you aware of that stuff? Like, do you notice that stuff? If that kind of like buzz is around you, or that, hey, I'm doing well and people are noticing?
I try not to look at stats or anything of that nature. And somebody's about to tell me, like, oh, wait, don't tell me. Tell me at the end of the season or when I'm done playing. I don't like to look, because then I start to think about it, and I feel like it's the worst thing possible to start thinking about your stats while you're playing, and that just brings the game to like a selfish level, and I don't want to do that. I want to be the best that I can for the team that I'm on, and you know, I'm just trying to produce, help a team win.
So you don't look at the stats, but you obviously know, I'm sure you have a good feel if you're playing pretty well and you get promoted from high A to double A, you know, pretty quickly after only half a season there or whatever. What do you think has been able to click with your game since coming out of college, that, you know, a little over a year removed from college, you're at double A ball right now?
I would just say the mental side of things. I've always been fairly good at the mental side of things. Mechanically, I feel like there's not much of a change, not too much of a change, but you can see little bits and pieces that are tweaked from college. But I just feel like the mental piece plays a big part of my success.
What goes into that mental piece? Like, I know you've talked before about, you know, the difference between soft focus and hard focus, and kind of the way you're channeling that focus and that intensity at the plate. You know, I know you have a lot of fun while you play as well. What does that mental side improving look like for you?
It's just continue to learn the game, like the ins and outs of the game. You know, this game's hard, and you're not always gonna produce what you want. So you gotta take little positives out of the game. Like, when you're struggling, you gotta find little positives. And then I feel like once you get those little positives, they start to stack up, and then you build up some more confidence. And then next thing you know, like, you're going consistently.
So when you were with the Curve, your manager there, Robbie Hammack, said, you play baseball without all the BS. Now, you look like you're having a lot of fun out there. Those things can coexist. But what does that mean to you if a manager says, yeah, Charles is playing with no BS? What does that mean to you?
I mean, I feel like that means I'm playing the game the right way, and not letting all that nonsense get in front of me and like affect my game.
Do you find being able to play with that joy, have a smile, enjoy it, like it helps with that side of things? If, you know, if there is a cold game, a frustrating game or whatever, and you know, keep the focus on playing the right way, like the fact that you do play pretty joyfully, do you think those things go together?
Oh yeah, absolutely. If crack a joke at somebody, they start smiling, and smiling's contagious. So they start smiling back at you, and the next, you know, it's just like big old blur of sunshine in the dugout and on the field.
That's great, man. So on the field, Jays have used you at third and first so far. I know the Pirates have played you at second and right and left as well. I think if we go back to like college and summer ball, you've played everywhere except catcher and pitcher. Where are you most comfortable? Where do you think your best position is, or the position you like playing the most?
The position I like playing the most is shortstop, but okay. I don't think I'll ever see shortstop again. But best position I'm comfortable at right now, I would say third base. I've been playing that mostly this year, and I feel like I got pretty good at it.
I know a couple weeks before the trade, you were also part of like an around the horn triple play as a third base. How cool was that to like, you know, you almost never see a triple play, especially an around the horn one. I imagine it's pretty fun.
Well, thing is, the play before, I definitely caught a ground ball to the finger, and my finger was hurting. I was like, well, if I throw this, my fingers start hurting. So that was my first thought when I caught it. I'm like, my finger might start hurting. But you know what? I've never seen this before in real life. Let me try and do it.
Well, man, it turned out. It's pretty cool. Okay, look, the fielding at third base, you know, coming along, we see a clip like that one. You've just hit a couple homers the last couple games. We know you can steal base a little bit. I know you've said in the past that you consider yourself or want to be a five-tool player. What does that mean to you? What does that look like? And, you know, how do you think you are on the road to being, you know, this well-rounded player that can do a little bit of everything?
I feel like I'm on the right track, just taking reps in my free time everywhere. That's I would say not where I'm necessarily the most comfortable at, I think is super helpful, you know. So when I finally go out and play a position I'm not used to playing, I could just go in there and not feel as uncomfortable as I would be if I had never like took reps there or anything like that. So I feel like I'm on the right path.
Okay, going outside of baseball a little bit here. I know you're a football player in high school as well. Are you still a football fan? Like, are you like getting ready for your like fantasy league drafts and stuff like that right now? Are you not that into it?
See, I'm not big into professional football, okay. But I'm bigger into college football. I really like college football.
Nice. Did you consider like how good a high school football player were you? Like, could you have picked between the two?
I could say that I properly played my role.
Okay.
If I was on the field, they knew what they were getting. They might get a little something extra, but they knew what they were getting when they put me on the field.
Did you find at all, like being a multi-sport guy, like one helps the other? Like you, I don't know, your route running or your footwork in football or anything like that translates to the diamond, or just kind of, yeah, it's just fun to do it all?
I mean, it definitely helped with toughness. I mean, you know, you can't be soft on the football field. Yeah, I mean, the way we did football, I don't know if any other school does it like that. And it's just a grueling summer. And in the off season, I was playing baseball, but I had to get my football work in too. It was just they did it well, but it's just you can't be soft playing football out there.
Okay, yeah. And I know you're not a basketball guy to play. I know you only. I think you've said before you played in grade eight. You obviously have the family lineage. Are you just like so tired of getting asked about that when people hear your last name?
No, it's a little different. I actually prefer it much rather than Charles. Like, what's going on with baseball? Or can I get an autograph?
Yeah, are you a basketball fan?
Not really. I'm a March Madness fan. Okay. I love March Madness brackets.
Nice. Okay, so for anyone who doesn't know, by the way, Bob McAdoo and James Michael McAdoo, both cousins of yours. I guess I should explain that to the audience first. Okay, so you're into college football. You like March Madness. Obviously, baseball is a huge part of your life. What else makes you you? Like, what else are you into off the field, away from baseball?
I'm a big Star Wars fan.
Okay.
And I watch a lot of anime, and I play video games.
Nice. Okay, what's the, like, anime of choice? Or are you just kind of all over the place?
I am all over the place. I've watched so much that I couldn't tell you like what the genre of choice is. I've liked a bunch. I've watched a bunch. Like, it's hard to say.
All right. Well, I know every team in like a lot of minor league parks do like their Star Wars night on May the 4th or whatever. We got to push for an anime night here at New Hampshire or Buffalo or Toronto or something like that. We got to work that in somehow.
That'd be unreal.
Nice. Well, Charles, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Congrats on the on joining the organization and the nice little start here, and looking forward to seeing more of you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Charles McAdoo of the New Hampshire Fisher Cats, one of the newest prospects in the Blue Jay system. Yeah, homered 2 days in a row. He's got four hits over his last three games with that Double-A New Hampshire team. And yeah, you talk about a fun prospect type, a guy who can hit the ball pretty hard, play a little third, bounce around the diamond. A little different than the typical Jays prospect. You know, we've talked a lot about Will Wagner this week, and it's like, okay, well, he'll get a lot of walks. He won't strike out a bunch, you know, line drive swing, maybe won't be a ton of home run power. And then with Charles McAdoo, it's more like, yeah, there's going to be some strikeouts. He'll take some walks because he's a dangerous hitter and pitchers will be careful. But there's real home run power there. There's some real stolen base potential there. It's cool. It's fun to see. And yeah, he was off for a little over there until the last couple games. And now he's rolling. It's been a lot of fun to see. We'll talk more prospects coming up at 11. Sam Dykstra of MLB Pipeline is going to join us. As I mentioned a little earlier, they've got their new top 100 out, their new farm system rankings out, their new internal top 30 for each organization. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk to Nick Pollock of Pitcherless. You can also, as always, send us text in the text line to 590-590. Standard data and message rates may apply. There's no game to tee up tonight. They're off. So we can take a look at some of your texts today and tomorrow as well. And as a reminder, tomorrow's game is an Apple TV Plus game. So we'll have someone from the Apple TV Plus broadcast on. I think it's going to be Heidi Watney, which will be cool. We'll set you up for that game. We'll set you up for that series tomorrow. And then, I mean, not a ton of updates from around the organization. I mentioned Arjun Amala continuing to stay hot there. It's pretty ridiculous. He's hit about 20% better than league average now, and this includes the cold start that he had before he got placed in the developmental list. Just on fire. We'll see what some of those prospect people think about him. The only minor league update from yesterday, other than Joey Votto continues to struggle a little bit at AAA, so I think the joining them for the Red Series idea might be out for right now. Maybe it's a September 1st target, not a Cincinnati Reds target. Hagen Danner is officially back off the IL for AAA Buffalo. So that one is relevant because he is a potential call-up as the Jays churn their bullpen here. If they need it, I mean, tomorrow starts 18 games in 17 days. So at some point, they'll have a 27th man for the doubleheader. I would just imagine you're going to see some bullpen churn. We got to see Tommy Nance yesterday. Maybe he comes down and Hagen Danner comes up, or there's, in addition to Blas and Espino as starters, there's Kwas, Yeri Rodriguez, Luis Frias, Brendan Eisert, Hagen Danner, who are all on the 40 man and at AAA. So you could see a ton of churn here between those guys and then Nance, Burr, Pop. I think Little and Cabrera and Green are probably pretty locked in on the major league roster, but everyone else, you could go down, you could come up. We will see how that goes over the next couple of weeks here. Again, 18 games in 17 days. So Trevor and Trenton said McAdoo's swing reminds me of Vladdy's a bit. That's interesting. It's anytime someone can get compared to Vladdy, especially right now, it's pretty ridiculous. Vladdy, I mean, I read some of the stats earlier about just the level of heater he's on to start a second half of the season. And second half of the season, we're drawing arbitrary lines, 26 game span. A couple of weeks ago, I was on Blue Jays Central. And I was like, okay, over this 30 game span or whatever, we're picking random points. But the overall picture is very strong too. So I've mentioned this stat before on the air a lot, weighted runs created plus. And what that does is it takes everything a hitter does. It adjusts for ballpark factors and, hey, the league offensive environment is down and things like that. And even though Vlad is not going to hit close to 48 home runs this year, by that stat that, again, controls for, hey, were you in minor league ballparks? Was the offensive environment better that year? Things like that. Vlad is now having a slightly better season by that stat, that offensive metric, than he did in 2021 for the whole, not just this heater that he's on. Now, I know that can look it can sound a little odd because Vlad hit 48 homers that year with 111 RBI. He's not going to reach those thresholds this year, but he's also hitting .323. He's got a career high batting average right now. His OBP is basically right in line with what it was that year. And the slugging's not as high, but slugging around baseball is down so significantly that Vlad OPSing .951 is about equivalent to Vlad OPSing 1,000 back in 2021. It's also worth keeping an eye on that Vlad is, I mean, he's probably not going to get there because Bobby Witt has a good lead here. But Vlad is in the mix for a batting title in the American League as well. Bobby Witt's hitting .349, so he'd have to cool off a little bit here. But then it's Judge at 333, Kwan at 325, Vlad at 323. For whatever reason, nobody in the National League is hitting well for averages here. Even Luis Arraez is only hitting 307. So he's the only hitter in the NL hitting above 300 while there are six in the American League. But yeah, in addition to, yeah, Vlad's turned on the power and he's got 25 home runs now and he takes his walks and he doesn't strike out and things like that. He's also at a batting average perspective right up there in the batting title mix. So that's how you end up with, no, he's not going to hit 48 home runs or 111 RBI, but it could turn out that by the end of this year, it's been as good an offensive season through a different way as that 2021 season, which is pretty cool. Let's take a break. Let's look ahead to the future. We'll talk to Sam Dykstra of MLB Pipeline about how the Jays' new top 30 internally stacks up and how the Jays rank around the league. That's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. The Jays have won several in a row. They swept the Angels. That's cool. That's cool in the present. I think people at this point in the year care more about, hey, are those guys chipping in going to contribute to the future? So let's look ahead to the future. Major League Baseball, MLB Pipeline released their updated farm system rankings and top 100 prospect list and top 30 on each in each organization. So let's dive in with that. We've talked about some of this stuff already, but we'll see what Sam Dykstra of MLB.com, of MLB Pipeline, thinks of it. Sam, how we doing, buddy?
Good, good. Thanks so much for having me.
No problem. So this is not a Jays question. This is a general MLB Pipeline top 100, top 900, really, since you do the top 30 for all 30 teams. What has this process been like post-draft and post-trade deadline, all of you guys coming together and trying to refigure this stuff out?
Yeah, I mean, it's a heck of a process, right? I mean, it's you have the draft in early July, you transition immediately to the deadline. Some deals happen a little bit before the end of July, and then we had a flurry of them in that weekend just before the deadline, trying to place all these guys as they are traded. So you can imagine what deadline day itself was like. One of my systems that I do is the Jays, of course, but also the San Diego Padres. They shipped out, it felt like, half their farm at the deadline, so that was a lot of replacing and doing things like that. And then once everybody is signed through the draft and everybody is in place after the deadline, that's when we're really grinding on this stuff, trying to get it out to folks and let you everybody know where their farm system sits, you know, at this point in August.
So how many of, like, obviously this is a huge undertaking and a lot of you guys are doing it. I know, like, you know, before the season, Keegan's the guy doing the Jays top 30, and then other right. people are adjusting kind of on the fly. Just how many hands are in this as you're going through? Like, my read on it from afar is how it would work is like, okay, you're working off of the original top 30, you're making the Jays adjustments, the Padres adjustments or whatever, and then you're like, okay, I could see these five guys getting into the top 100, let's put them in the pool and debate among the other people. Like, is that kind of how it works?
Yeah, so thank you for bringing up Keegan. Keegan does do our preseason list for the Jays and does a tremendous job on that and really grinds on that while being a beat writer in spring training. So I give Keegan all the credit in the world for doing that. Once the season starts, I basically take over the list from Keegan. I'm in touch with him throughout the season of like, hey, this is who I'm hearing is doing really well. Here's who's going to be next up on the list when somebody graduates, because we make automatic changes when somebody reaches 130 innings, 45 innings pitched, or 45 days of service time, 50 innings pitched, I should say, 45 days of service time. So we're always constantly adjusting on that. And then myself, Jim Callis, and Jonathan Mayo, we combine on the top 100 based off feedback we're hearing from the industry, what we're seeing on our own. We're adjusting that as we go along. We have some market corrections along the way, but it's really the big preseason list that comes out and then the in-season list that just came out. Those are our two biggest lists of the year.
So you personally, when you're looking at these guys, how do you balance, you know, hey, overall upside, this guy has the potential to be this, but the likelihood of him reaching that is not that high, versus, hey, this guy's in AAA, he's a little older, there's no way he's going to reach that ceiling, but we can project him a little better. How do you balance that? Like, I look sometimes like guys in the Dominican League will come up, and like guys who are like 17, 18, and obviously there's so much, there are so many years before we're going to really know. How do you balance that upside versus, hey, this guy's a little closer and Will Wagner's 26 when he gets called up. We have a good idea of what Will Wagner is versus Arjun Namala, who's 18 and tearing it up at A-ball, but he's 18.
Yeah, I'm laughing because when you were asking that question, my mind immediately went to those two guys, right? Like, Will Wagner gets called up the other night, does well, and I see a lot of tweets that say, Will Wagner was underrated. Why isn't he ranked higher? The guy can hit. And the guy can hit, but he is 26. He's kind of without a position, can play some first base, second base, third base, but will probably be floating around a lot. How do you weigh all that stuff? I wish I could tell you there's a magic formula, a magic algorithm out there. Thankfully, there's not. Otherwise, I would be out of a job and people would just plug that in and the rankings would spit themselves out. It's a constant battle. It's talking to people, what they're seeing, how you balance that stuff. I mean, for me personally, I tend to prefer position players to pitchers because, as we've seen in the Blue Jays system this year plenty of times, pitchers can break down more easily. And that's happening more and more as the game goes along and the way the game is transitioning from having a 7-inning starter to maybe a 5-inning starter. The impact of even a starting pitcher can be lessened. So they have to be really good if you're going to feel good about a starting pitcher. We actually have the fewest starting pitchers in our top 100, I think, in years at this point because we're weighing that part of it. There is no magic bullet for this. I think you like to go with upside with somebody like an Arjun Namala, and especially the way he's turned things around, that's made it easier to rank him where we did at number five. Somebody like Emmanuel Bonilla, who hasn't had a great year this year in the Florida Complex League, but the Jays were psyched about the way he reported to camp in spring, so there's still some upside there. We kept him in the middle of the list. It's a real debate every time we put these out, and that's why there are so many different lists out there and so many different opinions.
And which is great. It's always, you know, with anything, it's better to get a couple different opinions on it, a couple different angles, see where the gaps are. But one thing that is fairly universal, and I apologize for bringing you on and comparing the list that you guys do to other places, but, you know, Baseball America, Fangraphs, ESPN, MLB Pipeline, you guys all have the Blue Jays system ranked in roughly the same spot. There is, whether, even if people's opinion differ on specific prospects and upside and things like that, the consensus is that the Blue Jays, even after the trade deadline, even after a pretty solid draft, are in the bottom 10. They're in that like 22 to 24 range. You guys had them at 24. What do you make of that? The Jays did a lot of work the last month or so just to get back to 24th on your list. What is your read on just the overall system from that perspective?
Yeah, the thing I keep coming back to when I think about what the Jays did at the deadline, they essentially buoyed their place. And buoy, I mean, they just kind of bobbed right back up because you look at what the theme was of the summer in the Jays system, and it was guys missing time. Ricky Tiedemann now being out for probably all of 2025 with Tommy John surgery, didn't pitch much this year. He had the highest upside in the entire system. Brandon Barriera, a first-round pick of theirs last year, had an internal brace put in, and Tommy John, or Elvis Martinez was suspended because of PEDs. We might not see him. If we see him at all, it's going to be like for the last one or two games of the year in the major leagues. So I'm not saying the Jays got aggressive at the deadline because they knew like the farm system was down right now, but I think it helped the guys they picked up. Everybody talks about the Yusei Kikuchi deal, getting the three guys they did, Wagner, as well as Jake Bloss, as well as Joey LaPerfido, who's not a prospect anymore for us. He's graduated, but still a solid piece. Like, that's great. But they were kind of fighting uphill. Like, if these trades didn't happen and they just kind of stayed put, we'd probably be talking about them in the 27, 28 range.
Yeah, and I think maybe a good way to put that, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is I look at that top 30, and 13 of those 30 weren't in the organization a month ago. Like, is that that's a pretty good indicator of that term buoy of like, yeah, you got back to where you needed to be. And obviously none of those guys are the number one prospect. But yeah, a 13 out of 30 turnover, I would imagine that was near the top of the league in terms of turnover if we crunch the numbers.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, you look at like the Tampa Bay Rays, the Miami Marlins, the Toronto Blue Jays. Those are the three farm systems I really looked at the deadline that made themselves better, especially at building out depth. When you look at who was actually traded at the deadline, nobody in our updated top 100 actually got moved. So there weren't these big names to go out there and get. Some teams were paying pretty high prices, including the Astros, obviously, for Kikuchi. But a lot of this was just building out depth. And you look at who the Jays added. It's not a ton in their top 10. I mean, Bloss is there, Clase, McAdoo. Those are pretty solid additions. But I think most of what they did was add to that 20 to 30 range.
Which is, you know, it's better than having a worse 20 to 30 range. It's just not changing the, you don't have you're one of three teams without a top 100 prospect. Of course, your farm system is not going to grade that high. Let's talk about a couple of those guys specifically. So Jake Bloss, obviously the headline item in the Yusei Kikuchi trade. We've seen Will Wagner now. We've seen Joey Loperfido. But Bloss, you guys had him come in at third in the Blue Jays system. I know he was, as at times, been a fringe top 100 guy. What are your thoughts on Jake Bloss? I mean, this is going to be more of a how do the Jays want to handle the workload and stuff like that. But do you think he could capably slide into the back end of a major league rotation already at this point?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was interesting that the Astros brought him up as quickly as they did. Part of that was because the Astros were dealing with so many injuries, right? They just had open rotation slots. But then when they were turning to their third-round pick from last year, a guy who pitched at Georgetown. I mean, it's not like he pitched at Georgia. It's not like he pitched at LSU or Vanderbilt. He was pitching at Georgetown, and they really liked enough out of him, and he showed enough gains in that first half to earn those opportunities. I think what the Jays are doing with him right now, they send him down to Florida for a bit. They send him to their pitching lab just to understand how his pitch mix works, you know, what is best for him. And then they're going to develop a plan for him moving forward. He'll reestablish himself at Buffalo, kind of show himself off there. I wouldn't be surprised if he's making a few starts in Toronto, you know, by the end of the season, and then entering next year potentially as maybe their like number four starter. I mean, there's some serious upside in Bloss. He's been moved so quickly that it's a little bit difficult to like place him in that top 100 group for us just yet, because the major league time didn't go quite as well. But I see three above average pitches in his fastball, curveball, and slider. You'd like him to have more of a changeup to work against lefties. But for now, getting him for Kikuchi straight up would have been a good trade, given that he can be in their rotation for years to come.
So just ahead of Jake Bloss on the Jays updated top 30 is Treya Savage, who they took 20th overall in the draft, slid a little bit relative to where the consensus rank was. Another guy who, it sounds like, from reading guys like you, could be fairly quick through the minors. Maybe we're not pegging him in as a 2025 guy, but what do you like about Savage, and what makes him, you know, what gives him that potential velocity through the organization, like up through the minors?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real interesting pitch mix for Savage too. I mean, there's three plus pitches between his fastball, slider, and splitter. You take that every day if you can get it. He's got good size at 6'4", and he was a really good performer at East Carolina, not just this year, but the year before that too. So there, you can see all the pieces are there. I think part of the reason he slipped to 20th is some teams might have gotten a little concerned about some health things, just like how is he going to hold up over a full workload in the minors. You know, how do you handle him there? And he is just a pitcher. I mean, that's tough to deal with unless you're working with like a Chase Burns or a Hagen Smith, who went in the top 10. You know, there might have been some concerns there. But like, if you're the Jays drafting 20th, I think Savage was 11th on our draft list, you take him. And just and put all the pitching injuries to the side, but I think it helps to get another potential number two, number three guy in Savage at that spot. And like I said, you know, they'll put him in their pitching lab. They'll see what they think works best for him. But when you have that fastball, slider, splitter combo alone, there's enough there for him to be a quick starter next year. I wouldn't be surprised if he at least ends next year in AAA.
Which is great to hear, because like you kind of laid out off the top, Tiedemann probably going to miss all of 2025. Barriera, surgery. Landon Moraitis, surgery. Kendry Rojas is back pitching now, but missed a ton of time, injured as well, and he's only at A-ball. So, you know, is he Adam Mako mystery injury since the start of July here? I imagine a guy who, you know, was pretty on the radar with what he was doing at AA as well. So nice to have a couple guys in Savage and Bloss who are ambular. They're standing upright and they're not undergoing the knife right now. Talking about a couple more of the guys the Jays acquired at the deadline here. Charles McAdoo, you know, this is one of the issues with at trade deadline time, people firing up rankings from the preseason, because like, yeah, guys are, those are fluid, right? Like, and you guys are also like sharp on it and like quick to be like, hey, don't look at him as number 29. Like, I was going to have him at 13 or whatever if we updated this. He comes in at number 9 in the Blue Jays org. He was just on the show, so speak well of him. what do you like about McAdoo, and why has the opinion on him in the industry changed so quickly?
Yeah, I think he speaks well for himself, right, with that power that he was showing off the other day. Charles McAdoo, I mean, it was some questions about maybe defense on his side. He plays some third base. He plays some right field. That he's played even some first base as well. So, like, where do you fit him on the defensive spectrum? He's going to have to hit. But guess what? All he's done this year between the Pirate system and the Jay system is hit. I mean, he's hit for average. He's hit for power. There's been above average X velocities. He might get into, like, the 15, 17 homer range over a full major league season. Again, it's just, like, where do you fit him defensively, because if he ends up being like a first baseman ultimately, then he's going to have to be a 280 hitter with 15 plus home runs to really be valuable there. And even that might not carry a lot in today's game. But, you know, he's checked a lot of boxes so far. Being a college guy, he's performing at Double A or was before the trade, and he's just catching fire now with New Hampshire. I think there's a lot to like there, and I wouldn't be surprised if he ends up being like a 20-homer guy if this continues. It's been a big arrow up next to his name all season long.
Yeah, which is a lot of fun, and he was off to a cold start since he joined the Jays organization, but he's on fire this week, the last couple of days here, so that's fun to see as well. The other name I wanted to ask you about that the Jays acquired is Jonathan Clase. We've seen him with a cup of coffee in the major leagues with Seattle earlier this year. He's gone down to AAA Buffalo, and I mean, he's been on the wrong end of some BABIP stuff and things like that. But generally, he's been the guy that we expected from the Seattle organization. When you look at him and where he could go, how good that speed tool is, is there more there than a fourth outfielder type? Do you see the kind of the path for him to the majors being more of a fourth outfield defensive replacement pinch run kind of guy, or can there be more there in time?
I mean, I think it's going to be interesting because he is a switch hitter. So, like, at least you don't have to worry about him platoon wise. He can bat from both sides. For me, it's still going to be a fourth outfielder that he's had some decent power years, but I don't, if you look under the hood, the power's not quite there for him. He can run like the wind. We have him at a 70 power or a 70 speed grade, I should say. So I think bringing him in, allowing him to play some center, play some left, because the arm's not great enough for right, I think that's a pretty decent outcome for a reliever in Garcia. But I don't really see him carving out much more of a role than that. He is young. He is 22. Maybe we're talking about like some power gains in the offseason and it's a different story come spring. But as of right now, I think a guy who could be your fourth outfielder for a long time and be that pinch runner extraordinaire, that's not a bad move for a reliever like Garcia.
No, definitely not. And, you know, years of control and he's still young, so maybe you can work with him through the offseason and things like that. This is a bit of a weird one because it's maybe priced into the rankings already. But when you look at this Blue Jays system, is there anyone a little lower down the list or maybe not even on the list who you look at and you think, you know what, he's not there yet, but when we redo these come spring training, I could see this guy making a jump? Like, is there anyone kind of on the fringe of your radar like that, or is that too already baked into the rankings?
Yeah, I think it's too early for me to be like 2 days after the rankings came out, like, fair. I don't feel great about this one. There are guys that I'm going to be watching, right? Like Fernando Perez has had a really strong year, went to the Futures game, was their Blue Jays representative in Texas for that. Somebody who is currently moving up like in the rankings, and we moved him up to number 12. He could be in the top 10 if he continues his momentum. I really like the control of the arm. He's got a decent pitch mix there. I think he's the one who really jumps out to me. Like Desaun Brown, who's a name that Blue Jays fans have known for a long time because of his Canadian roots. He's had a really good year, and now he's at Double A. He's finally broken out of Vancouver after struggling there last year, returned there this year at a much stronger first half. He's somebody who's probably even faster than Class A and a better defender overall, I think, in center field. If he can just show that he can handle Double A pitching, I mean, he might be a top 20 prospect in this system now, whereas when we first placed him on the list in the preseason, I was like, this is kind of last chance saloon for Brown. If he doesn't hit this year, I think he's probably going to be falling off, and he's turned around those doubts and is performing well. So he has some momentum for sure.
Yeah, and it's exciting. Yeah, you mentioned the Canadian routes and part of a championship team with Vancouver in the Northwest League last year. Last Jay-specific one for you. We mentioned Arjun Amala off the top, so we don't need to redo too much of it. But when it comes to what the plan would be for him, he's obviously so young for single A even still, but he's hitting the cover off of the ball. Would you consider a late season bump to high A for him, or just keep it at A, let him finish with the strong season and reevaluate for next year? The reason I bring the question up is because they were so aggressive with him initially. If I wonder that is a part of the thinking generally.
Yeah, it's been such a bumpy year for Namala. I mean, you think about short season doesn't really exist anymore, except for at the complex level. Vancouver used to be a short season affiliate. So like everybody knew the day he was drafted, he was super young, he was still 17, that it was going to be a long-term process. I think he would have been a perfect candidate to get off the complex and go to short season ball in June if that still existed, but it doesn't. So the Jays stayed aggressive with him, sent him to the Florida State League, and it was rocky at the very beginning. They actually gave him a breather in the middle of the year, sent him to the Florida Complex League. He tore the cover off the ball there, regained his confidence, and now you're seeing what he's doing in the second half. To answer your question about like whether I would send him to Vancouver again, I think I would just let him finish the year on a positive note and just let him continue to crush in Florida State League. Go into your offseason with some optimism, with some momentum, with some good feelings. And, you know, it would be great to let him just dip his toe in the water and see what high A pitching is like. But given the rockiness of everything that came before this, Take the good when you can get it instead of ending on a potential sour note.
Yeah, that would be my lean as well. It's just anytime a guy has like a killer month or two, like we get those questions, right? Of like, are you going to bump him up?
Course, yeah.
And like, you know, the element that the Jays high A team is also in Canada is like, yeah, let's give the audience a little something. But yeah, probably better to just be like, hey, this season ended up in a really good place. Let's let it end in that really good place. I wanted to go outside of the Jays org with you just for a question or two here. So we look at the new MLB pipeline rankings. It's like, okay, the Yankees slid a little bit. That's nice. And then everyone else in the American League East has just like a banger of a system. The Rays are first. The Orioles are third. The Red Sox are seventh. The Guardians and the Twins are also in the top five. So if you're looking elsewhere in the American League, man, what do you make of that? I guess this is still a Jays-centric question in that you really do have to nail the free agent spending and what you do. You know, like you got to have some wins here because farm system wise, despite being a bigger budget team like some of these other teams, they're still just really behind even after all these moves and a good draft.
Yeah, I mean, part of that, right, is that the Jays major league team has been good for a few years now, ever since Vlad Jr. and Bo Bichette came up. So then you're going to have later draft picks.
Yeah.
I mean, getting somebody like Trey Savage at 20 is huge, but like in a normal year, Trey Savage isn't dropping that low and you're taking somebody in the 20s who's not going to be a top 100 candidate. So I think that's part of the thing that's affecting them. They've just gotten unlucky with injuries, like we said, but you look at the Rays, they're number one in our farm system rankings now. And a big reason for that is how aggressive they were at the trade deadline, even more so than the Blue Jays. I mean, they were trading away Isak Paredes and Randy Arozarena, who's like a legend down there. I mean, they were making some really aggressive deals to build out the system beyond the big names that they already have. The Baltimore Orioles, they are at number three, and that sounds great, but they were number one for such a long time. And now they've started to deal a little bit from that depth that they have, and guys are graduating. Jackson Holliday is going to be graduating by the end of the month if he doesn't get sent down, but I don't anticipate that because he's been much better. So, you know, it's taken years for the Orioles to get to that point where they are graduating guys and falling. Once a Holliday's out of the system, once, you know, Kobe Mayo's out of the system, he's in the major leagues now, they're going to drop, I don't want to say pretty precipitously, but like fairly so. I mean, they've just got so many high ceiling guys. And then the Red Sox have a few knocking on the door too, with Marcelo Meyer, Roman Anthony, and Kyle Teal, all of whom just got into AAA this week. They just hit really well on those drafts, taking high upside position players and developing them really well. I mean, it's tough sledding for the Blue Jays, but like you said, I think if they look at what their core is right now, and Orelvis Martinez will be part of the team next year. The suspension will be up. He's a piece that they can plug in with his power. They just need to build around that this offseason, maybe with some trades, but probably more in the free agent market.
Yeah, probably going to have to spend a little bit of money here. And yeah, Orelvis, I don't know. I think the number works out that there's six games left in the season when his suspension's up. So maybe we see him, maybe don't. last one for you before I let you go here. This is Ray specific. Junior Caminero's here. And I know if someone is scouting just the baseball card line, like he, for a 20-year-old, he had a good season at AAA, but overall, you know, hitting .276, 13 home runs, like the baseline doesn't necessarily scream this guy had to get called up, but everything under the hood is incredible. What are you looking for from Junior Caminero now that he's up?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a lot of power, right? He had his 2024 debut, and he hit a ball 116 miles an hour in that game. I mean, it was a ground ball to shortstop, which is part of his problem. He had, of his batted balls at AAA, more than 50% were on the ground. But it's loud contact. I mean, you compare his average exit velo, his 90th percentile exit velo, his hard hit rate at AAA. And I know AAA is not the major leagues, but it's like in line with Gunnar Henderson and Bobby Witt Jr. He doesn't play shortstop like those guys anymore. He used to. He's a little bit of a question mark at third base. The Rays have been pleased with how he's developed there over the years. Some evaluators I've heard from are saying he's still questionable at that position, but he's going to get a lot of run at third. And I think you're going to look at Baseball Savant every once in a while and see Junior Caminero's name at the top of the home run distance list and the top of the exit velo list. It's just, can he lift the ball with more, more often, more efficiently? And once that happens, I mean, the AL East is going to have to look out because he's going to be at that hot corner for a very long time in St. Pete.
Yeah, he's going to be a Sarah Lang special, the daily, here's the biggest exit velos and things like that. Sam Dykstra, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning, man. Keep up all the great work.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Sam Dykstra of MLB.com, MLB Pipeline. Again, updated top 100 list overall, updated farm system rankings, updated Jays top 30 within their org. Make sure you check all that stuff out. Obviously, we've talked to Baseball Prospectus and Fangraph, or Baseball America, Fangraphs, ESPN, all about how they see the Blue Jays system after the trade deadline and after the draft. And everyone's consensus is, yeah, they're in the 22 to 24 range. That is, I think every single place has them in that tight 22 to 24 range, better than being 27, 28, where they may have been without a good draft and without the trade deadline, but still a lot of work to be done. And you certainly can't rest on, well, we had a good trade deadline and that restocks the system. Yeah, some of it is where you picked, but a lot of it is pitcher injuries and, guys that, good floors, but without the superstar ceiling and things like that. None of that's to be negative. They still did good work at the trade deadline. It's still an injection of talent. There are fun guys like McAdoo and Class A and Blas. But yeah, that's a step one. A lot of work ahead. Let's take a break. Let's talk about what this pitching staff looks like the rest of the way here. Maybe some free agent pitching targets in 2025. Let's just talk pitching in general with Nick Pollock of Pitcher List. That's next as Jay's Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jay's Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Nice outing from Jose Berríos last night. One earned over seven innings, five strikeouts. Not a ton of swing and miss stuff, but a decent amount of called strikes, a lot of weak contact. Other than a Matty Tice solo home run, not much to report. I guess he did hit Kevin Pillar with a pitch as well, which, damn, that's an old friend, man. Don't do that. Yeah, but Jose Berríos, seven innings of pretty good ball without a ton of swing and miss. Sounds very similar to Kevin Gausman's start the night prior. A lot of this is probably just, hey, the Angels are not a particularly good team. But the Jays do have a fascinating trio of starters with questions about, hey, how much should the workload be down the stretch? Hey, what do you make of the stuff decline? Things like that. Let's talk about all that and pitching in general with our next guest, Nick Pollock of Pitcher List, of the Plus Pitch and the Craft Podcast. Nick, what's up, man? How are you?
What is happening? Thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on. Before we get into some of the pitcher specific stuff, I did want to ask. So you created Pitcher List yourself back in 2013. I know you've done stuff other places, Fangraphs, MLB Network, and things like that. But yeah, what drew you to that? And how have you enjoyed? I imagine a lot has changed since 2013 in the specifically in the fantasy industry.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I used to pitch in college. I was a travel baseball coach as well. And I'm just one of those lucky people who happened to fall into a job to make a WordPress site who knows about baseball too. And just like everyone else, I had my own fantasy teams. I was reading everybody else. I was like, you know what? No one's really talking about watching the pitchers themselves and having that bridge between analytics and actually saying like, all right, no, look, I can watch this guy and realize how good he is, even though the start wasn't quite right, and be able to talk about all that stuff in a different way. So I got really fortunate at the right time, I think. And I can't believe that MLB shut me down in 2014 for having GIFs back then, back when it was pitcher GIFs. So the times have changed. Fortunately, they provide video for us now. It's great. I absolutely love a lot of the things MLB is doing now. And it's just been incredible to see the access of data that we didn't have back then. I started our player pages that we have now because I didn't have that data. And to see it all so accessible now, to be able to talk about players in these different ways, it's just really exciting and really fun to just dive into everything with everyone so easily.
Yeah, and it's cool. And it's all like, it's cool what you guys do where it's like, yeah, this is really useful for fantasy baseball. I play fantasy baseball. You know, if people do daily stuff or, I don't know, there's the gambling component, whatever. But, like, it's useful for that. But also, like, because we have more of this data now, because everyone is actually watching the pitchers as well, more so than just like, oh, what's the gap between ERA and FIP? That's how I'm deciding right. Who's undervalued. It is like talking about pitchers for fantasy baseball is analyzing pitchers as well. So it's cool to see those things kind of married. And then you guys obviously have stuff like Process Plus on the hitter side, PLV on the pitcher side to help us with that stuff. When your process for evaluating pitcher, how much of that starts with the data side and then goes to video or vice versa? Like, how do you blend those things together?
Oh, that is, that's the age old question, right? We have so much data. We have so much stuff. One of the stats that I came up with is CSW. I came up with it while doing my daily article. I go over every single pitcher every single night. It's the only way that I can stay on top of all starting pitchers. And Baseball Savant has a game feed that allows you to see pitch by pitch what they do. And it was like this secret weapon I had back then. No one knew about it. Someone showed it once. I was like, what is that? I need that now. And they had swing strikes and called strikes separate. That one, that was before they were combining them. And I just thought that someone was doing that. And I realized that some nights the guys had swing strikes or normally would have a lot of whiffs, didn't all of a sudden. It's, because they threw called strikes and the guys just didn't swing. That's not on them. And if you combine that, it becomes CSW, right? And over time, I started to realize that there are a lot of these metrics that we are still kind of uncovering, and just how you think about it can really influence how you understand what the data actually means. There are some that we just know are good, like K-minus walk rate. That is just generally a very good predictor. What is so fun for me is understanding how all the pieces work together. And you cannot just say, look, this guy has this one stat that is really high, thus he is really good. There are some catch-alls that we like. On the hitting side, we have this thing called Process Plus right now that I just really do love. However, even that is broken up into components of they're making good decisions, or they're making contact, or they're hitting the ball hard. And understanding how each of those gets better or worse is really where the value comes. And when it comes to pitching, two guys can have the same exact line. They can have the same FIP of a given night. But once you understand the individual pitches that they throw, then you can understand, is this guy squeezing the most out of this? Or is he getting unlucky tonight and he could be better than this? Is there a gap in what he throws that could showcase more ceiling in the future? Or did he do something this night that's just like, whoa, that is not sustainable, and you aren't going to have the same curveball. You're not going to have the same velocity in a future night. So that's why we have the pillar pages that we do. I break it up by every single pitch. And part of the whole process for me in the whole offseason is just understanding right now, this is their concoction. This is how they get their strikes. This is how they get their whiffs. This is how the secondary pitch that they throw against lefties or righties or whatever it is. And then seeing how that fluctuates throughout the season. And that's how I answer it. Those wonderful metrics we have are good encompassing ones for quick hits. But generally, you got to look at all of it and really understand, is it successful? Is it at its best, or is it at its worst?
And then, within that, you're trying to, do some sort of estimate of even at the team level, it's a black box of like, well, what's the guy's capacity to like build on that? And like, hey, there's a gap here. I could see you getting there, but like, can you get there? Then, you hear stuff, and Eno told a story with you on the Kraft podcast the other day about Grant Holmes, right? And like the A's never tried to work on a slider with him. There was the story of Nick Mears when he left Colorado of like, yeah, nobody told me I was tipping a pitch. It took someone from another organization to tell a friend of mine to tell me that I was tipping. That's the black box stuff, right? Like player development wise is, I don't know that we can't know that Nick Mears is, we could watch and try to see if he was tipping a pitch, but we can't know that the Rockies are so far behind that they're not even looking at that stuff.
We can know about the Rockies.
We can't.
Everyone else, we don't know their virus joking around with you. That's the fun of it, really. And I've been really fortunate to be able to work with teams and players and really understand how it's different for guys. And, there's certain players, we did a series over the offseason on our YouTube channel where we brought in pitchers, Aaron Civale, Pablo Lopez, Jameson Taillon, Cole Reagans, these guys to watch a full game with them and to say, cool, what are you thinking right now? What is working for you? What isn't? And they told stories of every single at bat and what they're doing. And you see with some of them that they say, okay, cool, I'm just going for a blob over here. I don't feel good about this. Others saying, all right, I'm going to go exactly here. I see that reaction. I'm going to go there. And pulling back the layers of what organizations have, how they go about pitch development and approach and what they're telling the player and what the player says, no, I'm not good at that. I'm going to do this. It's fascinating. I think there are a lot of teams that do it right and a lot of teams that don't do it well at all. It's really difficult to discern. Because we say things like, oh man, the Guardians are really good development. Look at the pitchers that they've had over the years. But then you realize that their minor league development is really good. But then we've had reports from some of their players saying that their major league development is bad. They don't do good things once they get here, right? We talk about the Giants, but then we realize that, oh no, Kai Correa was there. Their infield defense coach was absurdly good. And that was just an amazing defense behind them.
Yeah.
And then then they leave, a couple guys leave, and all of a sudden that team doesn't necessarily have the best pitching development. So it's tough. It is fun. It is, I think the joy of it is uncovering, yeah, Granholm's didn't throw a slider. How do you not teach a guy like the best, at least try it. It's the best pitch in the majors, a slider. Try that. You know, why isn't, look, hire me, guys, just have a month. If you're pitching development in the minors where you're not trying to get guys out, you are just literally going through the Rolodex of pitches at every start. Just experiment with everything. What's the harm? You know, I feel like we have to take another step up universally in development. I think some teams are doing that, but it blows my mind, that story. Aminos has so many good stories like that. And that's incredible.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I guess the hitters would be like, no, please don't. We need like three teams that we can hit off of that aren't developing guys enough. Let's pivot to some specifics, pitcher stuff. So I mentioned, as I brought you in here, Jose Berríos with a good start last night, not a ton of swing and miss. It was the same as Kevin Gausman's start the other night where, seven innings, very little swing and miss, but a lot of weak contact. Kevin Gausman's had such a fascinating kind of up and down season. The last two starts were arguably his best combination of two starts all year. The first time he's gone seven innings in two starts in a row since May of 2023, and he missed like no bats in those starts. For you guys, he's probably over the last 2 years gone from auto start into the like questionable depending on opponent tier.
Oh man.
What have you made of Kevin Gausman's season so far?
And you're incredible, by the way. You're plugging so much of my stuff. That's the daily streamers that I do. So with Gausman, the reason that he was so good and getting all these strikeouts over the years, he had 31% strikeout rate last year, is because his splitter always had a 20% plus swing strike rate. That's just the bread and butter for Kevin Gausman. And I mean, I'm looking at everything since the 19th of June. He hasn't had a single game of a splitter above a 20% swing strike rate. Actually, the last one was June 8th against Oakland. Okay, great. So without that splitter being that pitch, it's harder for Gausman. The most interesting thing to me is that his four-seamer is really a strike pitch to set up the splitter. It gets hit hard. We have a stat here called ideal contact rate, which you might have heard of, say, hard hit rate or barrel rate, which is important, but there are other forms of contact from hitters that are good for them. There's a thing called solid hit rate. There are burners, which are really hard hit ground balls that have a high chance of being a hit as well. So we combine it all and we say ICR, which is just ideal contact rate. And for a pitcher, you want to be underneath 40% allowed on pitches, especially for your fastball. When you get to secondaries, you want to be underneath 35. Gausman's is always like 45% on the four seamer. And he's always gotten away with this because he gets called strikes on it and he gets a lot of swing and miss on the splitter. The splitter's so good to make up for it. But without the splitter being a big whiff pitch, he's now relying on the BABIP game, or I like to say, you know, Koufax above praises a man. And yeah, that's not a fun game. You can do that against the Angels. He was fortunate against the Orioles as well. But this is really a battle at the moment. The good news I have for you is that Gausman is locating well. He is getting that splitter down and arm side as he traditionally has in the past. There's something about it, though. There's just not enough break on it. There's not enough bite. Maybe guys are reading it better out of the hand. I'm not exactly clear. But I'm not going to be sold on Kevin Gausman until he starts getting those double-digit whiff games again with the splitter.
Yeah, it's tough. And I mean, there's also going to be... I mean, if you're a fantasy player, like Gausman was like, if he has a bad outing against the Angels, he might be like droppable territory, which is crazy where he came from. And you know, Berríos and Bassett are not super high strikeout guys, even though they can eat some innings for you and stuff. I wanted to ask you about a couple of the Blue Jays who are a little newer, maybe to the radar. And I know this morning in your write-up for the next 2 days, you had Yariel Rodriguez as a questionable start against the Cubs. The Cubs, just kind of an okay offensive team. Right. And then we'll see Bowden Francis on the weekend as well. Bowden Francis coming off of a couple of really good starts, including two okay ones against the Orioles. What have you made of those two guys? Are you interested in them as they kind of man the fourth and fifth starter roles down the stretch here?
Sure. Yariel Rodriguez doesn't go very long in games.
Right.
His last start against Oakland was the first game at 85 pitches. And generally the Jays say 80 pitches. That's fine. We're good with that one. And with Yariel, he really is a two-pitch guy in my head, a four-seamer that has cut action to it, that has done an actually surprisingly good job at limiting ICR, that is, allowing more weak contact than a traditional four-seamer. I think it will go away. I don't think it's that sustainable. While, of course, he has a slider that he really does establish the zone with a ton, and that's really the game plan. I don't generally love that game plan where you have two pitches as the predominant ones. Yes, there's a curveball in there, sometimes a splitter, a rare sinker, but it's really four-seamer slider, where neither one to me are truly elite. The slider is solid. It is very good. I would love this with a really good third pitch as well for a strike instead. But this slider really is everything, and then the fastball has gotten away with not allowing that hard contact a ton. I don't think that lasts forever. For fantasy terms, it's the Cubs. It can go either way, maybe like 5 1/3 or so, two runs or something like that. You're not going to expect a ton of strikeouts because it's just those two pitches. So it's fine. To me, a guy like Yariel doesn't do enough. You need to have a little bit more of a ceiling for me to go after a guy like Yariel, where it's just like, yeah, I'm not going to get, you know, 80 pitches. So you need to be able to... I need not more than 80. So it needs to be like 7 strikeouts or so. I need to feel confident that there's going to be a win in there. And you don't really know because that Jays lineup, unfortunately, isn't looking too good in the bottom half.
Yeah, at least against the Angels, they're managing to put a little bit on the board there, but that's the Angels as well. Bowden Francis, so, and I think that makes sense. And to be clear, where I see this from a fantasy lens of, if a guy's only going 4 2/3, he's not getting a quality start, he's not getting a win. You've got to, like, unless it's going to really help the ratios, which at this point in the season, you know, your ratios are probably torched if they're torched. And I guess if you play a week, like a head-to-head, it can be helpful.
Right.
But yeah, you need the strikeout juice there. Bowden Francis would have fallen into the same kind of category. The last three starts, he's gone 5+, though, and the last one going 7 innings with 8 strikeouts. Do you have a little bit more interest in Bowden Francis as he gets a turn against the Cubs here?
Yeah, it's interesting. The shape of his four-seamer is much better with Bowden Francis. I think there's more of a ceiling with that pitch than with Yariel Rodriguez's. Because when it comes to pitch shape, the things that matter most on a four-seamer, obviously velocity. You want to throw it hard, that's good. But you also want to get vertical break. Essentially, is it going up or at least looking like it's staying up longer and thus guys are swinging underneath it? Do you get really far out, which gives less time for the hitter to react to the pitch? And of course, are you coming at it at a flat angle? This is actually not an of course. This is something I really had a revolution on myself or enlightenment in the past year or two, which is the angle of which the ball comes in gives more or less time for the batter to intersect with the bat. That is, they are at an angle, they're like angling their bat up, and how long is that ball coming in matching that bat path to get an intersection point where they can make contact? If it's really flat, which Bowden Francis actually is kind of flat on his four-seamer, that means that the bat and the ball intersect at fewer points, which is pretty cool. And if he can get it upstairs, that would be great. He doesn't really. The command of Bowden Francis is not that stellar. And when you look at the secondaries, I don't really know which one I trust. Is it the curveball? Probably not. In the last start, that was just not a thing. That was a 50% strike rate. The slider was used 8 times and it was fine. I don't know. I see Bowden. I see these two strikeout games of 15 combined over 2 starts. And I hope that he can overpower with the fastball. But the secondaries often, you know, leave him hanging. And it's too risky for me to go after. At the very least, I think he can go a little bit longer in games than Yariel does. Yariel isn't as efficient because it's really just two pitches and he nibbles with them. While Bowden can just kind of throw them in the zone and hope for the best with five different pitches. Kind of like how Chris Bassett does it. But he does it with like seven or eight or nine or whatever number it is.
Yeah, and so this is Chris Bassett's the pseudo-pitching coach at this point, it seems like. Yeah. Sometimes. Just
it's
like
so ridiculous what Bassett does. It's so fun.
Yeah, and like he's helping Kevin Gausman add a two-seamer. He's helping Bowden Francis add a splitter. What doesn't Chris Bassett do? Okay, let's zoom outside of the Blue Jays here. We've only got about 5 minutes left. But in general, if you're a fantasy player and you're trying to play the stream game because we're a little late in the season here, or you're headed to the head-to-head playoffs, or you're trying to, you know, salvage some of your roto stats or whatever, what are you looking for outside of just, hey, this offense? Like, obviously, if you have a pitcher with any strikeout potential and he's pitching against the White Sox, you stream that guy. Outside of that obvious an example, what are you looking at for when you look at, you know, the available probables day-to-day?
Yeah, I think the number one thing to really, if you just want to circle one kind of guy, don't always make it your DJ Hers types who are high strikeout chances. Those are what I call cherry bombs, where they're either super sweet or they blow up in your face. And that's more of a risky proposition. I think actually the more conservative route is you go for these guys I call Tobys, who are not really exciting and they get their work done, but you're not happy they're in the office, like Toby from The Office. And that is kind of like your Jose Quintana, your Martin Perez, who, if you are watching game by game, these are command pitchers who routinely every year have moments of rhythm. And it's remarkable that if you actually are looking at the strike zone plots and you're saying, oh man, Jose Quintana is avoiding the heart of the plate. He's doing the whole neckbeard thing of making the facial hair around the zone. And that works. You have that from Martin Perez just doing well against the Pirates. He was rostered in fewer than 20% of leagues, and he just went 7 innings and or 5.1 innings and eight strikeouts or whatever ridiculous amount it was. It was great. It was so productive, and now he's on the Padres. There are guys like that, if you are following it and you see like, oh no, you've had two starts of having your command and you have a decent matchup here. Those come around every single week. Those are the ones I would be circling the most, as opposed to the trying to find the next Spencer Schwellenbach. So you play that conservatively, you can actually do really well, especially in September when there are fewer managers also vying for those streamers. And a lot of guys are not really paying attention that much. You can certainly find a lot of streaming options in September.
Yeah, Quintana's been one of my, I've picked him up and dropped him a couple times as the schedule allows. Yeah. And like, he's got the A's, and then he's going to get Orioles Padres is next to, or Orioles Diamondbacks. But then it's like White Sox Reds maybe. So it's like Quintana's going to be on and off. Spencer Arrighetti, I've picked up and dropped 30 different times this year. It's
he's doing it finally.
I know. Maybe. Finally getting the return. Quickly, we've only got about a minute and a half here, but what did you make of Zebby Matthews' debut?
Oh, he's so good. He's actually a really good command guy. It's so rare inside of a debut when you have all these jitters and adrenaline affecting you to have as good command as he had. And the fact is that he has five pitches, and you're only through three because it's your MLB debut. Just throw the things that you're most comfortable with. Don't extend. He has five. The change on the curve, I think, are going to come more alive. He has such a good cutter. That cutter he threw to MJ Melendez that he hit out of the park, I literally said as he threw it, wow, what a great pitch. And then he hit it out of the park. And I couldn't believe it. That's normally like a can of corn out. Zebby Matthews is the real deal. He's not going to be like an 8-10 strikeout guy likely, but he throws hard, great command. I love the guy.
Yeah, it was fun to keep an eye on that one. And yeah, I was with you. I didn't think that was... didn't think that was getting out. I thought MJ Melendez, one of the most annoying fantasy guys on both sides of the ball now. It's unfair what he's done. Nick, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Keep up all the great work at Pitcher List. Invaluable for a guy like me, invaluable for baseball fans.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great talking with the stuff with you, man.
Yeah, thanks so much. Nick Pollock of PitcherList.com, also the Plus Pitch podcast and the Craft podcast with our pal Eno Saris, a lot of great stuff there. You know, it's someone good to talk to because like I still have like a huge chunk of things in my notes to have potentially asked Nick about, but we are done the show in like a minute and a half here. So thank you to Nick. Thank you to Sam Dykstra, Charles McAdoo, and Julia Kreutz for joining us today. Had a question in the text line that I wanted to mention. It's from Scott and Owen Sam. Why are Bassett, Gausman, and Barrios still pitching? So I did this as a pregame hit on Blue Jay Central the other day, and then BNS talked and I talked about it a little bit on the show. The reason is, I mean, one, those players, there's a human component and a player management component. If you go to those three guys and say, we want to shut you down with 7 weeks left in the season, they're not going to want to do that. And you can't just option them. Like, they would have to be injured and hit the IL and that not be a grievance kind of thing. So they have to have buy-in on it. That is one component. Two is you don't have the horse. Like, you don't, who's going to pitch for you the rest of the way is a big question. And yeah, you don't really care about the outcome. So if Andrew Bash gets a start and Paolo Espino, whatever, you're okay with that. But the big one is that Gausman is at 139 innings, Brios at 149, Bassett's at 134. Even if you want to shut those guys down and ease up on that, if you plan to have them as a part of your rotation next year, you want them to throw 175, 185 innings next year. You don't want to, the term is, deload them too far to where by the time they hit 175 innings next year, they're fatigued by it, they're worn down. So yes, absolutely want to be aware of their workloads, scale it back, maybe go to a six-man rotation at some point, skip a start here and there, phantom IL them with 10 days left in the season, whatever. You can do stuff like that. But if you tell Chris Bassett you're done after 134 innings and then we want you to throw 190 next year, that's not going to work out. Thanks again to the guests, to everyone in the text line, to Amit Mann, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. We will talk to you at 10 a.m. tomorrow. Have a wonderful Thursday.